From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. As you probably know, each week an editorial committee meets to think about the top articles that are being published in the cardiovascular journals that we see. And we try to pick a dozen or so that we think are very relevant to people who are practicing cardiovascular medicine. Not infrequently, we'll find in a given week there will be two or three articles in a theme area, and I can create a podcast that sort of focuses on that theme. And so this week is no different. I found three articles this week in different journals that are relevant to anticoagulation. And of course, this is a field that is rapidly moving with the creation of the novel or direct-acting oral anticoagulants, and of course, their application in a whole variety of thrombosis-type settings. So I've chosen three articles to review with you this week that relate to this theme. The first article is entitled Real World Use of Apixaban for Stroke Prevention in AFib, and it's a systematic review and meta-analysis published in the journal Stroke this week. This is a very large and ambitious meta-analysis. It included 16 studies that met specifications of the scientists, and it included over 170,000 patients who had been treated with apixaban. Six of the studies came from the U.S., four from Denmark, two from Sweden, and one each from several other countries. And they're relevant studies because they're from 2015 to 2017. So this looked at patients who had a mean age in the 70 to 76 year range, and of course they were getting anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation. The study investigators looked at various comparisons, and as you know, we don't have large randomized trials in all areas to compare the effectiveness and safety of warfarin, the traditional anticoagulant, to the newer agents. In the studies that looked at apixaban versus warfarin, the overall sense is that the two agents were equally effective in preventing stroke and or thromboembolic events. Warfarin appeared to be superior to low-dose apixaban, but regular dose apixaban seemed to be superior to warfarin. And as you know, apixaban seems to have an improved safety profile for major bleeding, GI bleeding, and particularly intracranial hemorrhage or hemorrhagic stroke. In the studies that looked at direct comparison between apixaban and dabigatran, these two agents were thought to be equally effective in preventing stroke or any thromboembolic event. The low-dose apixaban seemed to be reasonably efficacious, and apixaban had an improved safety profile for any major bleeding, GI bleeding, or any bleeding. And of course, this has been one of the concerns about dabigatran, the GI side effects, and particularly GI bleeding. In some of the studies that have looked at apixaban versus rivaroxaban, certainly rivaroxaban looked to be quite good. It was equal to or superior to apixaban in preventing stroke or any thromboembolic event, but apixaban had a superior safety profile for major bleeding. Clearly, the meta-analysis, I think, demonstrates that in the real world, all of these agents, apixaban, warfarin, dabigatran, are similarly effective for prevention of stroke or any thromboembolic event. Rivaroxaban certainly looks to be excellent as well. Apixaban may have the better safety profile when compared to these other agents. And of course, it's not likely that we're going to have huge, large, multi-center trials that will compare these agents head-to-head for every type of thrombosis problem that we face in practice. A second article was published in the New England Journal, and it's called Pharmacomechanical Thrombolysis for DVT. And as you know, major proximal DVT can lead to a significant complication with post-thrombotic syndrome. This was a randomized trial of 692 patients who had an acute proximal DVT, and they were randomized to either anticoagulation alone or anticoagulation plus pharmacomechanical thrombolysis, an intervention designed to break up the clot and reduce this post-thrombotic syndrome. So over 24 months of follow-up, there was no significant difference in the presence of post-thrombotic syndrome in the two treatment groups. What was remarkable in this study is that the frequency of that was nearly 50%. There was no difference in the recurrent VTE episodes between intervention and control. And the intervention group, as you might expect, did have more bleeding, actually 4 or 5 times more, 1.7% versus 0.3%. When they looked at moderate to severe post-thrombotic syndrome, it was 18% in the intervention group and 24% in control. This had a p-value of 0.04. And the overall post-thrombotic syndrome severity scores were on average lower in the intervention group compared to control. So the authors concluded that overall, the use of pharmacomechanical thrombolysis for acute proximal DVT did not lower the risk of PDS, but it did result in more major bleeding. I think it's important to note that there was a trend for benefit here in terms of the post-thrombotic syndrome, and if the study had been powered with more patients, this may well have been a positive trial. The perspective of the ATTRACT trial was that it was designed to test the notion of an open vein hypothesis that acute DVT should be treated in this way and fewer long-term complications would ensue. And I think what's most dramatic about the trial from my point of view is the fact that this PTS problem was present in nearly 50% of patients, no matter which arm they were randomized to. So we have a long way to go in treating that condition and understanding it. My guess is that there is a group of patients who would benefit from this technique, but we need more studies and better definition to figure out who they are. The last article I'll talk about was a paper entitled Resumption of Oral Anticoagulation Following Traumatic Injury and the Risk of Stroke and Bleeding in Patients with AFib. And this is a study that was published this week in the European Heart Journal. It was a study looking at almost 4,500 Danish patients who were hospitalized for traumatic injury that resulted in discontinuation of oral anticoagulation. This included things like brain injury, hip fracture, or injury to the abdomen or torso. They looked at all-cause mortality, ischemic stroke, major bleeding, and recurrent traumatic injury. And resumption of the oral anticoagulant was assumed if a prescription for the oral anticoagulant was filled within 90 days from the date of discharge. The drug studies, of course, included both vitamin K antagonists as well as the novel oral anticoagulants, and the frequency of use was roughly 60% of patients had vitamin K antagonists, 16% the novel oral anticoagulants, and the oral anticoagulant was not continued in the remaining 23% or so. Interestingly, in this observational study, in the group that did not have the oral anticoagulant continued, there was a higher prevalence of traumatic brain injury, prior bleeding, and concomitant use of antiplatelet agents and other drugs, so that this group may well have been biased in terms of higher risk. The main endpoint of the study was to look at whether or not resumption of oral anticoagulation was associated with a lower risk of mortality, ischemic stroke, or a higher risk of major bleeding, etc. And the authors concluded from the observational study that the resumption of oral anticoagulation in this observational study was associated with a lower risk of mortality or stroke. It's a vexing problem, and I think one of the things that's important about the study is how challenging this group is. Generally, in particular, patients who've had intracranial bleeding are a group where clinicians are very hesitant to restart oral anticoagulation. And certainly this study and some others would suggest that we really have to think about, for some of these people with particularly AFib, we should consider resumption of the oral anticoagulant at some interval. It may be after 6 weeks or in this study after 12 weeks. There's not a lot of randomized data in this place. We probably won't see randomized trials, and we end up having to use our best clinical judgment, thinking about thrombosis risk, bleeding risk, frailty, and other things that can help inform us. So I think in summary, three articles, each dealing with a slightly different aspect of anticoagulation in cardiovascular care, I thought the three articles together made an interesting group for discussion. Obviously, we need more science and we need more large trials to help inform us. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org, and all of this information can be found on the ACC's website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.